Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About.
Welcome to Let's Get Busy.
That's right. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, kidlit notables, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 161 with Paul Volpone, author most recently of Game 7, published by Viking, an imprint of Penguin. Paul's walked a storied life, including working in a drug treatment program for teens and teaching incarcerated youth on Rikers Island to read and write. His life experiences and interests are the subjects of his numerous YA novels, and his newest novel was inspired by a single image in a newspaper clipping of a floating green car. How he gets from there to the story of the greatest Cuban baseball player of all time to a do-or-die refugee mission is awesome. You're going to want to hear this. If you like what you hear, I encourage you to download other episodes of Let's Get Busy on your computer or handheld device by subscribing through your preferred podcast host, like Stitcher or iTunes, or by visiting the Let's Get Busy homepage directly. Rating the podcast through stars or reviews on the Stitcher app or on iTunes actually helps the podcast reach a greater audience, which also translates to these podcast hosting tools recommending Let's Get Busy to other listeners, which is a very good thing. Definitely do that if you want to help bring the chats to even more ears. And on that note, it's time to start episode number 161 of the podcast with Paul Volpone. You want to take it?
Let's get busy.
Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Paul Volpone. Hey, I'm excited to make your acquaintance tonight.
Thank you. It's great to be here with a man named Winner. You must be the king of self-esteem.
Oh boy, could we just have the Let's Get Busy therapy hour going on right here about the Paul, I gotta say, just selfishly, not even talking about your wonderful, wonderful books. First, I just got to say, man, I'm a guy who has grown up with the last name that should be the easiest for any person to pronounce, and my word if it wasn't pronounced 100 different ways. So I don't know how you get Weiner, Wiener, whatever out of it, but you, I should say you on the other side get a prize-winning horse named after you.
Yes, I'll take it. And there is a play by Samuel Johnson called Volpone.
Oh, man. One day, well, they're every year that I watch the Olympics, they do say that there's winners. So that does make me feel a little good.
There we go.
Well, Paul, congratulations on the release of Game 7, which is it, as I understand, your 11th novel for teens?
Yeah, the book means so much to me.
I was
sitting at home, and we had stopped our newspaper subscription. Our brand new newspaper delivery man thought it was cool to come at 10 o'clock in the morning. And we got so mad at him. He just couldn't get it together. He wanted to get here by 6, but he couldn't. He was just 4 hours late every day. So we canceled the newspaper, and my wife got electronic delivery of the New York Daily News. And my wife and daughter just loved it. But for me, I'd love to cut things out of the newspaper and save them in a box for, like, books in the future. Little thing I might throw into a book. And while we had this newspaper online, I saw this picture of a floating car, and it just stuck with me. I was just flipping through, and it was a green car floating in water. And when I passed it by, it stuck with me, but I was busy thinking about something else. And days later, I started thinking about this photo. I couldn't remember if this car was floating in somebody's pool or in a flash flood in the desert or something. But I went on this massive search to go back and find that picture. I didn't know what it did to my brain, but I just needed to find that picture again. Finally, after days, I hit the right keywords on the Associated Press website, and I found the photo. It was of a green 1959 Buick. And I don't know if you're aware, but in Cuba, our old cars are their new cars. Because of the embargo, they don't get new cars.
Okay, yeah.
And some refugees took a green 1959 Buick, turned it into a floating car boat, and sailed it the 90 miles from Cuba to the U.S. And the picture I saw was of a couple of Cubans, refugees, sitting on top of the roof of the car as the Coast Guard boat came to get them off of Key West, Florida. Oh, and just a look on their faces and in my head imagining what they'd been through, I decided right then and there I wanted to cut myself off from the reality. I didn't want to know their names. I didn't want to know their real story. I wanted to imagine who they were and how they got there. And that turned out to be game seven.
Whoa. So from seeing a single image in a digital newspaper, all of that poured a story out into you. That's amazing.
Yeah, it just you know, it took me by the throat and wouldn't let me go.
Oh, man. Well, your story is great. And I've got to say, as a guy who doesn't read a whole lot of sports fiction, I love the sort of poeticism in the way you write about baseball. I really, really enjoyed the way that you describe it, and the way, I mean, also hear that you clearly are a guy that likes to write about family and likes to write about sort of coming to know oneself and one's identity through the sport you play, but also the way that you are connected in your family, the role you play in your family.
Yeah, I think you've got that right. For me, sports is bigger than the game. For me, sports is just something you do to connect with people. And that's what I like about this book and some of the other things I've done as well.
Nice. Well, would you mind, now that we've hinted at it a little bit, would you mind just giving sort of a summary, a book talk about Game 7, letting the listening audience know what it's all about?
Well, in Cuba, baseball is just so big. And I had dreamed that one of these young people on that floating car boat was the son of the greatest Cuban baseball pitcher of all time, someone called El Fuego, for his blazing fastball like smoke. Mm-hmm. And his father had defected years ago when he was about 10. His father defects. And he comes to America, and he's making millions pitching for the Miami Marlins baseball team. And the son, Julio Jr., is stuck back in Cuba. He is the son of a defector. So all the props that his father had, the money and the position, that all has gone away. And he's living the life of a defector's son, which is not perfectly good. The government's down on him. And as Julio Jr. grows to be 16, he becomes a great shortstop. And he wants to play on the junior national team, the Nacionals, who go traveling to all the different countries to play the best young baseball players around the world. But the Cuban government taps on his shoulder and says, listen, your father defected and embarrassed us once.
Yeah.
Don't think we're going to put you on this team for you to embarrass us again when your father tries to steal you out of another country. And so now he's facing two deficits. He's living the life of a defector's son, and here's the game that he loves, and he's being stopped from playing it at the highest level because of what his father did. So now he gets the opportunity to defect himself. And I don't want to ruin it any more than that for people who don't like too many spoilers, but that puts us in motion. And I'm really proud. I really talked to a lot of people who used to live in Cuba. I went around here in New York City. We have a couple Cuban cafes, and I was lucky to meet some people who experienced what it's like to be, under the thumb in Cuba, and people who also made their way out. and listening to some of the perils that they'd been through. And I was able to use that in the book as well.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's a life that so many of us here have no idea about. But that dream of coming to America, of making yourself that way, of risking your life to start a new life is something that's so compelling to read about.
Yeah, it was really touching to be able to put it together. The book is split up into three 10-chapter units, living in Cuba, on the sea, because by now you know he defects, and what happens in the last 10 chapters, what happens to him once he's here, trying to reconnect with his father.
Yeah, well, it's. I feel like the way that I know that you are very present in our schools. You go out and do a lot of school visits and a lot of Skype visits. And whenever I think about, on the other side of it, as a librarian, I love having authors like you come in. And one of the most powerful things that is always amazing to see, because it just takes the right person talking to our young people for this to happen, is just the way that your story connects with people and the way that they see themselves in the story and the way that they see the stories of their families represented there too.
I just love to do school visits and get up in front of students. I was a teacher for 16 years.
Yeah, what did you teach?
I taught English. I taught English in the world's largest jail, Rikers Island.
Oh, at Rikers, I read that. Yeah,
which is just two blocks from where I live. And if you ever want a glimpse of what it's really like to be in jail and be a teenager, read Rikers High. Because although students and teachers sometimes take a tour of the jail, believe me, they only let you see what they want you to see. If you're there every day, you see the system break down for real, and they can't hide it from you.
And you were there for 16 years?
I was there for 6 years.
Oh, 6 years. I'm sorry. I heard that wrong.
And then I worked with those same student inmates once they get out and put into programs for the rest of that time.
Oh, okay.
I was actually in the jail with them for 6 years. But to get back to your original point, I love to get into classrooms, because when I was in high school, I didn't read. I had the same English teacher three times. Her name was Miss Sussman. If you ever see my book, Black and White, she's the English teacher in that book. And I had this game I had learned to play with Miss Sussman. Every September she'd bring in a cart full of books, and in my head I'd be sitting there going, oh no, please, not another book to read. But by the third time I had Miss Sussman, I had learned how to play the student game, and I'd be the first one up to the front of the room, and I'd take a book off a cart and I'd shine it up. I go, oh, thank you, Miss Sussman, for bringing us these wonderful books. I know I'll read it and learn so much. Then I take the book and stick it deep in the back of my desk and never touch the book again. The only time I would touch that book is when we were reading it in class. Then I take the book back out and I bend up the cover and the pages, like that book was really going back and forth home with me on the train and the bus. And I just sit there and listen to the classroom conversation about the book. And after a little while, I started to know the names of characters and some things they'd done. And in a couple minutes, I'd start to raise my hand with confidence and answer questions about a book I had never read. And I find out as I go around from school visit to school visit that experience is not so uncommon.
No, but I mean, imagine what's even – to step back and look at it from an observer standpoint, the notion that your listening skills are becoming that attuned to know to listen for the right cues – in order to be able to participate, is something that there is some credit going on there for being able to do that. And same with these kids that are able to fake it, if you will.
Yeah, and I love to be able to show students that books come from real people. Books don't come from some machine. Books don't come from people who are smarter than us. I watch TV and I chuckle at the same kind of things everybody else does. And I think when kids get to meet me, they realize, hey, Paul's not any smarter than we are, but he just likes story. Same way we do. We tell stories all the time. We go back and forth. And I think kids leave me with a sense of, hey, Paul can do it. He writes stories about what goes on around him. We can do that too. And most of the students we meet basically do have those stories in them.
So are you seeing How did you then come to reading? Was it just in being able to read independently that you found something that you liked? Because I would imagine being, like in class, being required to read something often has exactly the opposite effect. It kind of makes you not want to read anything at all.
You know, probably the most famous scene in American literature is when Huck uses the N-word talking about fooling Jim and playing a practical joke on him. And that's the scene everybody discusses. They want to take the N-word out of it. And I remember reading it in high school, actually reading it in high school, not faking it, but reading this scene. And I sat there and I said, Twain's a genius. He put these words in the mouth of a 10-year-old, not to show that the 10-year-old is prejudiced, but what society is at the moment. And I raised my hand and I said that, and the teacher just did handstands. and that got me kind of hooked from not reading to reading.
And the very able to appreciate it. Yeah.
And the very next thing I went out and read was Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, which to this day as a whole is my favorite book.
Really?
And I remember we got a chance to visit the library in Detroit, and I was able to speak to students there in the public library. And when you speak in the public library in Detroit, they have this chair they put you in on the stage. And apparently they've been using that chair for quite some time. And they give you this little book to sign. And other authors who have spoke there have signed that book. And I looked down, I looked through the book, and I saw Steinbeck's name. So I'd love to have been sitting in the same chair or the same place Steinbeck had been sitting in. And I said, wow, that's a great connection, especially for me. And then I looked back not too far, and Dr. Seuss was there.
Oh.
So that felt good.
Oh, man. You know, you're making me think about how it's not – sometimes it's not about reading. It's more about hearing a story. And maybe you're hearing the story by reading the words, but that you're being part of I don't know, experiencing this story, of having the story challenge you or change you or cause you to think differently about things.
Yeah, that's the best part of stories.
Yeah, no doubt.
And I don't know if you guys can hear it, but the I'm sitting in my basement right now. The UPS man just came to my door.
Is that what that was?
And my dog, my dog Galaxy, who's a black dog with dandruff, and my daughter said, ooh, it's like he has stars all over him. Galaxy just threw a little fit upstairs. If that's what you heard in the background, guys.
Well, I'm waiting for the thunder to crack through on my end. We've had a horrible storm system come through that delayed bedtime quite a bit around the winter household.
There you go.
But yeah, no, it's fun. It's fun to have guests of all types on the podcast. We've had certainly we're no stranger of dogs. We've had roosters and a couple of parrots and things like that as well. So it's totally fun.
I went to ALA one time, and a rabbit had written a book, and,
and
his caretaker was holding him up, and anybody who purchased the book could have the rabbit eat part of it as an order.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yes, it's quite good. I forgot the rabbit's name, but probably not that important.
But still, this rabbit ate my book.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But I could go on a tangent about that, my word. Hey, so you like sports. Sports, you said, are bigger than the game itself being played. You write a ton of sports books. Is this how you this is sort of your in for connecting with teens? Or is this just like you are passionate, there's nothing else that comes to your mind when it comes to telling stories? Great characters, but let's set it in this vernacular that I know, that's sports.
Well, I've written a lot of stories without sports, but I do appreciate it when it jumps up in the right place. You would ask me where I grew up, and I would say Queens in New York City. The real answer is I grew up on a basketball court.
Really?
I learned to walk onto a court. I learned to hold my head up on a court. I learned to trash talk on a court. I learned to confront people, and I learned to embrace people. See, the cool thing about basketball is you can be walking down the street and there are five guys on a court you don't know and they need you to be number six. And you walk in there and suddenly you have a bond. There are people you can't stand. There are people you might like. And funny, the guy on the other side of the team that you hate the most, 5 minutes later, they choose up new sides, and suddenly he has your back. So that's a great turnaround in sports for you.
Yeah, and that's to be able to grow up with that experience is just, man, I love it. There's always so much, I feel like, so many great ways that the playing sports, the playing games, which is something that people have done since the beginning of time, informs the way that we are as a culture. And I think rounds everyone out sort of in the best of ways, the way that we rely on one another and build sportsmanship and trust in one another.
I definitely agree with that. I think the great Duck Duck Goose book has not been written yet.
Yeah. Could you imagine?
That game, that Duck Duck Goose game.
I'm like secretly not I'm hoping that yet. that it's not been written yet, just that that's like one of the manuscripts in your filing cabinet that you're getting ready to work on.
That would be
the epic battle. And you could just call it Goose.
Yes.
And then all of the 30-somethings like me will right away flock to it because they'll think it has something to do with Top Gun. But
okay.
Also it'll have to do with Duck Duck Goose. It practically writes itself, Paul.
Thank you.
Oh, man. Hey, and you also, I guess I wanted to bring this up because it was just on my mind, that you also write about horse racing, right? I live in outside of Baltimore. So Preakness just passed us, and that's...
Yes, I was rooting against American Pharoah because now I will be going to work at the Belmont Stakes with 120,000 people breathing down my neck. Very tough day to chase quotes and talk to people. But, yeah, you know, one of the great things about writing horse racing stories is the multimillionaires who own the horse and the people making barely minimum wage, who are the grooms and helpers who love the horses and basically are the ones who keep them sound. That dichotomy is just amazing to me.
But it's still that. It's still that intact that it's the extremely wealthy right alongside the people that have just nothing.
Yeah, it's amazing. I once got to interview Alfred Vanderbilt, who at one time during the Depression was the richest guy in the world. He was in his maybe late 80s or early 90s when I interviewed him about it. And it was, you know, to see him sitting there, you know, in those big leather chairs at the exclusive club of the racetrack and also see the relationship he had with the people who took care of his horses. It was really interesting.
Huh. That's not something that I can understand because I don't have, I can totally get down with the people that are taking care of the horses, not the people that have uber wealth. But I feel like in order for it to work, you are the money behind it, but you have to know that the team of people that are taking care of this investment of yours, are instrumental in your success.
Yeah, you know, the horses can't speak for themselves, so sometimes,
there you go.
Sometimes the sports writers have to do it.
Yeah, how about it? Hey, so I want to go back to you visiting schools, if you don't mind. Is that all right to bring it back around to that?
Oh, I love that. It's one of my favorite things to do. You know what I'm doing lately?
Yeah.
Because so many schools reach out to work with me, but they may not have, at the moment, a classroom reading one of my novels. So one of the things I'm doing is I'm working with creative writing classes around the country. Students will send me, they'll take one page, whether it's the beginning of a novel or a short story or a poem they've written, whatever they can get on one piece of paper, students will in one class, the teacher will gather that up, send it to me. I'll spend a good couple of hours going over all of it and make notes on every student's writing. And then during Skype, I get to meet every one of those students, find out what's going on in their lives, find out why they wrote the story they wrote, what motivated them. In some instances, they read part of it to the classroom who hasn't got to hear what that student has written yet. And then I give them a kind of feedback of things I see in their work and things they can focus on. And it's been so rewarding to see the amazing work some of these students around the country can do.
Oh, I'd have to imagine. And Paul, for you to give them a chance to be seen, to submit, however, I'm working with their teacher, but to submit whatever one page's worth of work that they have created. And like you're saying, in some cases, have never shared with anybody. And here they're sharing it with a stranger, a well-published stranger, mind you, but a complete stranger to hear this feedback. I mean, that just speaks to me about the teacher that you are.
Well, thank you.
Being able to see kids through their writing.
And I'll tell you, I was so moved by a pair of poems I received by two different students in Miller Place, New York, that actually took this young man's poem and this young lady's poem and put it up on my Facebook page. people around the country to see. People really look like there's some great comments about those two poems that went up.
Well, I mean, that's the power we have as teachers, as librarians, as authors, as people connected on social media, to be able to publish a student's work, to give voice to a student's work on a level that they didn't realize that they could ever reach. Even if that just means, like, I don't know, the school blog or the, you know, some sort of local publication like that, or something like on Twitter or on Facebook, where a ton of people that have no stake at all in these kids' lives, so they have no reason to be disingenuous with the children, or with the, I would say children, but you're dealing with older children than I am. but to have that come back to these kids, I mean, that might be the one thing they need to hear, that they've never had someone give value to their writing ever before.
I'm just amazed at the number of students who are in their heads or on paper looking at the world around them, at their friends, at their family, and looking at stories, things that happen to them, things they see happen to kids their own age. And whenever students like these write these kind of stories, they're so real because they know how their friends speak. They know how their friends would react. And just that, to see so often how someone else's problem touches them, if they would sit down and write about it. And sometimes they're not even, you know, our best students who are passing. Sometimes they're just students who are hanging on. But students sometimes who are just hanging on, they're really captivated by the world around them. They haven't brought that to classroom to achieve a good grade yet. But the things around them touch them and give them feelings. And to see them write about these things is just amazing.
Would you ever consider doing some sort of an online platform to be able to gather, to collect and share these out, to be some sort of a source for publication for them? Even if it was, I don't think it would be viable to do something in print, to sort of do some sort of like a collection of them or something, but to be able to give, I don't know, some sort of a place for all of this.
Well, I think it's being done in a lot of places in a lot of different ways. I think a lot of kids who are good at it have their own blogs.
That's true.
And there are some kids who just don't realize that. And probably they can share with other kids. I think really the individual library media specialist in each school, I think that they come across these kids at a high rate. And I've been really impressed how some of them around the country have their own clubs, which they bring these kids together and they concentrate on writing or talking about stories. I'm always amazed. To me, the most important person in the school is always the librarian.
It makes me feel really good to hear you say that, as you're going around and seeing other schools, and certainly knowing the colleagues that I have in the profession that I have. I feel like we are positioned to be the heart of the school if we just work to do it, if we work to carry that banner and to advocate for our readers and to be there for them. And actually, that brings up a really good point, too, that I've got even a number of elementary colleagues that are taking digital work that the classes are creating, the students are creating, and adding it to their databases so it can actually be searched within their catalog, ebooks that they're creating. And so it wouldn't be any different to go into a middle school or high school and publish their work that exact same way. I mean, publishing tools are so easy. It's so accessible now. The world that we have grown up in and that these children are growing up in, you publish, you know, by the moment through microblogs like Vine and Tumblr. And
I agree with you. I tell kids all the time, it doesn't matter whether your work gets published, whether you're on a library shelf. It's a great place to be. But the fact that you would sit down and think about writing, that your friends, your family would see it, that really makes you a writer.
Yeah, the thought behind it. I feel like that's where it's separated. When there's time put in, any time put in, to think about how you're composing a story, how you're sharing a story with someone else. It's huge. I guess I keep coming back to you though, for you to come back and affirm the writing that these kids are doing and to place value where I'm sure their teacher is placing value, but their teacher sees them every single day and the kids might have really complex relationships with their teachers. So for you to come in as a writer, as someone making a living doing this and be able to affirm that work too is something that's very pivotal or potentially pivotal in their careers.
Yeah, I see them smiling when they see that I like it.
Ah, see, that's good. You see, and I got to remind myself, you're seeing middle school and high schoolers smiling.
And just to tell you, I like everybody's work. I can find something in everybody's work that's good.
That's it, man. This is what's making you true gold, because you are this person that sees that you can see the good. It's there. It is absolutely there.
Thank you.
Even if we just say, yeah, even if the good is just that you sat down and committed time to write this, to commit it down on paper or digital paper, that's everything has value. I'm glad that you are a person out there in front of our kids doing that.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed it.
Well, I see that we're already at the end of our time, but I'm glad that I had this time, Paul, to get to know you. And more importantly, now that I know that you are out there reaching our teens and sharing your story with them and your strong voice in storytelling, but also that you're helping them along as writers and to see value in their own writing.
Yeah, I just love being at those schools. I mean, to see it all in progress, to see it growing day by day, it's just fantastic.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. Well, before I let you go, I'm going to ask you the traditional question around this podcast, and I'm certainly going to open it up to any and all experiences you might have. And so let me reframe it. I'm assembling an all-star kid lit dream team kickball tournament. And Paul, I'd love to know what one
person. Ooh, kickball.
I know, right? I want to know what one person.
Better than Duck Duck Goose.
I know. This is going to be epic. I can't wait for you to write this book. What one person alive or past from the kid lit or YA lit world would you want on your team and why?
Oh, man. I met Chris Crutcher. And him, myself, my wife, and my daughter drove across Michigan to get from one speaking engagement to another and then to an airport. And we were both going in different directions at the airport. But we spent the whole day together talking to kids and just talking in the car. And we just had a great time. If I was ever in a literary foxhole, I would want him there with me. Because he just seems, you know, totally brave and fearless when it comes to storylines and what he believes in. Because, you know, he's probably had his books challenged more than anybody else.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure of it.
And he's got a fantastic attitude about it. He's got a fantastic grip on what he wants to write and who he wants to be. And I would think in that literary kickball foxhole, as the ball's flying over our heads and trying not to get hit, I would pick him.
Ah, nice choice, Paul. Well,
thank you.
Listen, thanks again for coming on the podcast, and congratulations for Game 7 coming out and all of these connections you're going to make with readers to come. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you, and hey, for me to spend this time with a winner, Matthew, that's fantastic.
Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts.
That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.